Happy June 13th, and welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Happy June 13th.
Hey,
it's a happy day. Flag Day, which I believe has Philadelphia roots. I'll have to look that up, but I think it has something to do with the Second Continental Congress. Whatever. I'm on a tangent. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Today on the show, nothing about Flag Day.
Nope.
We're going to talk about medical debt and its impact on your credit score and how that could be changing thanks to a new rule proposed by the Biden administration. That's later this segment. Middle segment today, we're talking with R. Eric Thomas, a friend of the show, a local writer, and recently minted as a nationally syndicated advice columnist. So we'll talk to him about the nature of giving advice.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the show today, a Father's Day themed interview. I talked with a local dad, Joe Gajunas, who also happens to be the creator and star of a new docuseries on WHYY and PBS stations across the country, focusing on modern fatherhood. So we just sort of rapped about being dads.
And I'll have to say, dad-to-dad conversation, I haven't heard it, but I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you're looking forward to
your
it.
Your second Father's Day coming up.
My second Father's Day is indeed coming up, and I think his eighth is coming up. If you have thoughts on advice, and specifically I am curious, if you've ever gotten a very good or very bad piece of advice, give us a call or send an email. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you didn't know, that's 888-477-WHYY. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. Cherry, first, let's wheel through some news headlines.
Yeah, well, this story sort of caught my eye. Did you know, Avi, that about 10,000 Americans turn 65 years old every single day?
Happy birthday to them.
I know. And this has the federal government preparing for what's been called a silver tsunami. Let me give you some stats. Currently, 18% of the population is aged 65 or older, but that number will shoot up to an estimated 23% by 2054. And with so many older folks, older residents in America, it'll place an increased strain on health, long-term care, housing, and transportation services. So now governments are creating right now or trying to create the infrastructure needed to take care of these individuals. According to the Department of Health and Human Services recent report, there will be a need for accessible communities, age-friendly workplaces, high-quality long-term care services, all those things. And Pennsylvania just unveiled its plan. Did you know, Avi, Pennsylvania is the fifth oldest state in the country in terms of age? And by 2030, people over age 60 will represent a third of the state population. So that plan is called Aging Our Way Pennsylvania. It's a 10-year roadmap for improving, quote, the way older adults are cared for and how they are received. New Jersey's doing something very similar, putting millions of dollars toward this, other states as well. So this is going to be a pretty big deal as we go through this silver tsunami.
I was thumbing through the report this morning, Aging Our Way, PA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just thumbed through. Didn't look at the whole thing.
Yeah.
A lot of nice platitudes about nice things that we want to do. Not a lot in there about what's actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm curious about. Like, for instance, I'll give you an example. They talked about trying to prioritize helping people stay in their homes. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean tax breaks for people over a certain age or more tax breaks? Does it mean grants to help people
transform their homes,
transform their living spaces? And if people stay in their homes, what does that mean for the housing market? What does that mean for all other types of things that it could ripple into society? So, you know, there's a lot more trade-offs than just niceties would have you believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious how Pennsylvania and other states try to confront this demographic reality.
Yeah, and they're going to have to think about parks, transportation. How do you make sure people can get around? A lot to talk about, a lot to think about.
Here's some more stats for you, and these are good stats, really good stats. Philadelphia, according to some new data, has experienced one of the nation's biggest drops in gun violence so far this year. This is federal data that was compiled and analyzed by the Center for American Progress, which is a left-leaning think tank. According to this think tank's analysis, among major cities, Philadelphia has seen the largest decline in gun violence injuries and deaths compared to last year. So that's year over year. The data is current through the end of April. So the first basically third of the year or so, we've had the biggest drop in gun violence injuries and deaths compared to every other major city that's adjusted for population size. Pretty remarkable.
It is pretty remarkable. I checked the homicide rate. We're down 40% from last year. And that number is actually this year, it's half of what it was in 2021 when we had that record-breaking homicide year. But I will tell you, one death, one shooting is too much, because when you talk to people in the community, a lot of them still feel like, especially if they're plagued in high-risk communities, they still feel like it's pretty high. So the perception, the feeling that people have is a little lagging. But these numbers, to me, are definitely very encouraging.
Encouraging. But I also wonder, maybe I worry a little bit, that violence can be cyclical.
Yeah.
There was a huge spike after the pandemic began, and for reasons that we can probably guess. And now it's coming back down. And I think the question you have to ask yourself is it coming back down sort of naturally as part of a naturally occurring cycle? Mm-hmm. Or is it because of something we're doing right now, a policy that we should continue to invest in or expand? That's a huge question to ask, right? You have to try to separate those
two.
And it's hard to isolate the effect of a policy versus something that's just sort of occurring on its own that would have occurred regardless of what you have done as a city.
And that spike happened during the pandemic, where people were disconnected from services, people were isolated, had mental health. So we don't know if that was a unique time and if now we're just kind of returning back to normal or if it's something
regressing
else.
To the mean, right?
Yeah. So let's move down to Delaware.
Let's take I-95 down to Delaware.
Or some might call it Delaware. And apparently there are road signs on the I-95 corridor, Avi, leading into Wilmington. They're headline attractions, but the actual road sign, these signs have been blank for nearly a year. I've actually seen this when I was living in Wilmington, going back and forth.
So the sign says attractions
at the top, but then there's no attractions listed. It's just blue and blank. So, So who did this? There were four signs were built by Delaware's Department of Transportation. It was part of a reconstruction project, which began February of 2021. And there's part of the state's Blue Logo program, but they hired this New Jersey-based Delaware Logos, and they contracted with them, and they were supposed to solicit businesses to be featured on these signs, and they were going to pay a fee. But they're empty because why? Bureaucracy, red tape, contractual issues. And while they had been installed as part of the 95 project, there had been no coordination or input from the Logo program. And so the Wilmington mayor's deputy chief of staff has said that Wilmington's slogan, which is in the middle of it all, is sort of like a joke now, because a middle of all of what? Because these signs are sort of blank on 95.
I'm trying to understand what happened. So basically they built these signs, but they didn't tell the contractor they were building the signs. So the contractor never solicited bids from businesses.
Yeah, and so now they're blank.
So now they're blank, and it makes it seem like there's nothing to do in Wilmington.
But there's a lot to do. But these people are supposed to pay for
a
placement on the signs. Yes.
You're putting your foot on that?
There's things to do. I will say a lot to do, but things to do. Yes.
They have a great jazz festival.
That's coming out very
soon. They sure do.
Yes.
One more story, and I know this was a story that really caught your eye, Cherry.
It did.
The ex-girlfriend of a late Pennsylvania man could inherit about $1 million as the beneficiary on his retirement account. This man used to work at Procter & Gamble, and, you know, as a result of working there for a long time, his retirement account was worth a lot of money. That doesn't seem too unusual, right?
No, absolutely not. But
they have not dated in a long, long time. These two people, this ex-girlfriend, dated this man who is now deceased in 1987. The relationship ended after 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And not on a good term.
And not on good terms, according to the man's family. However, the man never changed who his beneficiary was on the retirement account. Just left this woman's name. And so she's claiming, with some good evidence, that she should receive the money. His family, his estate, is saying, wait a second. He did not intend for you to get this money. It was a clerical oversight.
Yeah, I mean, and they've been fighting about this payout in court since 2015. And to me, I mean, for those who've had relationships that didn't work out, I say, you know, you need to check your beneficiary forms, people. Go update those things. Because the last thing, I mean, think about this. This guy's brothers are now trying to get access. This money should go into his estate. But the ex-girlfriend from the 80s, I mean, she has a legitimate claim on this.
It's a good PSA.
Yeah.
The guy worked at Procter & Gamble, which I will note owns Pepto-Bismol. And let me tell you,
this is a Pepto-Bismol worthy moment.
If I was his family member and I saw her name, I would have needed a big old glug of that, because this is unbelievable. And like you said, a good reminder to check your beneficiary forms. They really do matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they are legally binding.
Yes. They really are. So we're going to go to our newsmaker. And this week, the Biden administration proposed eliminating medical debt from credit reports. It's a move that would impact millions of Americans whose credit has been lowered by overdue hospital bills. Here's Vice President Kamala Harris speaking in Charlotte, North Carolina yesterday. Take a listen.
Debt is not just about a financial number. It's about how it weighs on people to keep them back. Nobody asks to be sick or experience a medical debt. It's not something people bring upon themselves.
This proposal does not forgive those medical bills, but the administration says it will make it easier for people to get mortgages, buy a car, and take out other loans. Joining us now to explain is Sarah Cliff. She's an investigative healthcare reporter at the New York Times. Sarah, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And so, Sarah, I wanted to start this conversation by giving us a snapshot of the overall problem. Medical debt, what's the overall price tag and impact on Americans?
Yeah, the kind of one-word answer is large. Our healthcare system is the most expensive in the world, and patients often find themselves facing really significant bills they just can't afford. Not necessarily because they made a bad financial decision, but because their kid broke the arm, because they ended up in the emergency room for some reason. It's difficult to estimate about how much medical debt is out there. The federal government had estimated there's about $49 billion sitting with collection agencies right now. So big number. And the debt that the Biden administration is talking about is that specific kind of debt, the debt that hospitals have said has gone unpaid. Not the type of things that are in payment plans, but bills that have been sitting around for a little while and have been sent off to a collection agency.
You hinted at it there, Sarah, but I think the administration is making the argument here that medical debt is different by nature than other kinds of debt, in part because it can be unexpected. Can you sort of parse that for us?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure as you guys know, interacting with our healthcare system, there's often very little information or little choice about what you're going to pay. You know, in my career covering healthcare billing, I've seen MRIs that cost as much as $25,000 and ones that cost $500. And you don't know when you go to the hospital, nor can you usually find out which one it's going to be. And, you know, like you pointed to, often it's not really a choice you're making. It's not like a choice of renting an apartment, buying a car. It's something, you know, you need. And I think that's why the Biden administration is saying this type of thing, it shouldn't be considered when deciding how creditworthy you are. It's not a good reflection of your propensity to repay your bills.
And so let's look at how is medical debt treated now, and how would the new Biden rule change things if it were enacted?
Yeah, so right now, if you have a medical bill that's gone unpaid, usually for over a year or so, a hospital or a doctor could send it to a collection agency, which would then take over trying to recoup that money for you. There had already been a little bit of change in whether the collection agencies would send that stuff over to the credit agencies, and the credit agencies are the ones determining your credit score, that thing you need when you're getting a mortgage, looking for an auto loan. So right now, a medical debt could affect your credit score if it's larger than $500 and has been around for more than a year. What the Biden rule would do is take all the medical debt out of the equation when your credit score is being calculated. It just would not be counted in the way that another unpaid bill might be.
And so who will this help, and will it actually help them? Because I've seen some debate about how helpful this would actually be.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. The government estimates there's about 15 million Americans who have some kind of medical debt that's affecting their credit score. They are more likely to live in the South, a part of the country with less robust health insurance coverage. They are more likely to be Black or Latino. And in terms of, you know, would this help? I think it's actually a pretty interesting question. There is certainly a group of people who, if this rule does go through the public comment-making process, if it does get enacted who will see their credit scores rise. At the same time, this isn't getting rid of that debt. Hospitals can still keep pursuing that outstanding amount. They can garnish wages. They can sue people. They can even, I've seen hospitals cut off care for patients who have outstanding debt. So it's a very, economists kind of think of it as a very downstream intervention. It's not getting rid of the root cause, which is this big bill that has gone unpaid. It is kind of dealing with the symptoms of that outstanding medical debt.
So given that, I mean, let's talk about the politics of this. I mean, the election is about 5 months away. Do you think something like this will sway voters, especially those in key portions of the Biden coalition that are necessary for him to win in November?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's a bit of uncharted territory. You know, we just don't really know what happens when a policy like this is enacted. One concern that's actually been raised to me by some economists is, you know, is it possible that by getting rid of reporting to credit agencies, will hospitals be even more aggressive in collecting their debt because they kind of see, oh, this other avenue has been cut off. We can't kind of scare people that their credit's going to go down. Maybe we need to use other tactics. So it feels a little uncertain to me what this policy, how it's going to play out, what is going to look like. But I think it is the Biden administration attempting to get its arms around one of these issues that just perennially, you know, dogs American consumers, which is this really, really high cost of healthcare bills that, you know, all of us tend to face in one way or another.
Well, we will follow this rule, especially if it gets enacted. Sarah Cliff is an investigative healthcare reporter at the New York Times. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, coming up, Cherry, we're going to talk about giving good advice. It's an age-old problem. Some people do it with their family members, close circle of friends. Some people give advice to millions. And our next guest does that now. It's columnist R. Eric Thomas, friend of the show, and recently minted as a nationally syndicated advice columnist. So we're going to get advice from him about how to give advice.
Yes. And if you have the best or worst advice you've ever gotten, you want to share, the number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm asking Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm asking Cherry Gregg. Advice columns. Friends, are you a fan? Think of the greats, Ann Landers, Dear Abby, Miss Manners, Ask Amy, and now here comes best-selling author and playwright R. Eric Thomas. Asking Eric, the new advice column will replace Amy Dickinson's Ask Amy, which runs in 150 papers around the country. She's retiring at the end of this month.
Now, R. Eric Thomas is not new to giving advice. He's dished it out in Elle magazine and for Slate's Dear Prudence column. But we wanted to talk to him about the advice business and his philosophy for guiding readers through life's problems and puzzles. He also happens to live in Philly, so we were able to get him to stop in the studio, which is great for us. Welcome back to the program, R. Eric Thomas.
It's so good to be back here. And as Fraser Crane said, I'm listening.
All right. And friends, our listeners, have you ever written to an advice column or do you just enjoy reading them? What is the best advice or the worst advice you've ever gotten? Give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
I'm curious why you decided to go with Asking Eric instead of Ask Eric. Was that like a conscious choice or just like a differentiating type of thing?
It was somebody got to the name first kind of thing.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I think the website was taken. It becomes that simple. Yeah,
so you
yeah.
just add the ING.
Yeah, just add the ING. You know, like we're doing the
spelling
bee on
New York
Times.
I was ready for some sort of deep philosophical answer.
No, you know what? I should. Let me rewind the tape. You know, it's all about being in process
present.
In the moment.
Yes.
We are walking through this journey together.
Thank you. That's what it is. Thanks for humoring me.
And so I want to know how you got into this business of giving advice. Are you the person in your family, among your friends that everybody goes to? Is this like a natural version of you, or is this like an alter ego?
Well, here's the thing. In my family, people don't realize that I'm in charge. Like, so they just do whatever they want to do. And I'm like, okay, but I told you what to do. I think one of the things in my friend group, I don't know that I am the one person to go to, but I think that my long history of storytelling and writing memoir and frankly making a lot of mistakes in life has made me somebody who people go to a lot with their questions, their problems. I love listening. I'm also very nosy, and I will hype you up, or I will tell you what the truth is, depending on what you want to hear. So when the opportunity came to do this professionally for first for Dear Prudence and Slate, and now here, I took it very seriously, and it also was really exciting. It felt like a natural progression of the arc of my career so far.
So we did ask our listeners for best / worst piece of advice they've gotten, and Rachel emails with some really bad advice that Rachel got. Okay, I live in Philadelphia, met someone online while visiting upstate New York. We really hit it off. I invited him to come down to Philly. He accepted the offer. We were still in the COVID reality, had a fabulous weekend, and I thought maybe I'll kiss this guy before he leaves, but I'm not someone to do that really soon. Rachel's friend convinced her that it was the best way to see if we were going to be a good match. Rachel followed the advice. 3 weeks later, Rachel got mono.
Mm. Oh, no. Mm.
So here's the question based on her.
Sorry, Rachel. Yep. I'm sorry.
That's a good story, man. Oh, my God.
And I assume Rachel's recovered now.
Yeah.
So we could all laugh about it.
Mm-hmm.
But look, there are real world consequences when you give advice.
Yeah.
How do you, does that weigh on you? How do you deal with
it? Oh, absolutely. Well, one, the thing is you realize very quickly when you're writing advice is that people will let you know very quickly when you didn't get it right in their opinion. And sometimes it's like, look, you would have said this thing. I would have said this thing. That's fine. A lot of advice columns in the long history of advice columns are these sort of directives. You must do this. I approach it in a very different way. One, because there's just so many other voices out there. You can, obviously you can go to therapy, you can ask people online, you can go to Reddit, you can do all these different things. So if you want somebody to tell you what to do, I'm not your guy. Yeah. What I will do is say, these are the doors that you can walk through, and this is what's going to be on the other side of that door.
Yeah.
And I take it really seriously. There's always an initial impulse when I read a question. I'm like, oh, this is what they should do. But I like to walk around with the question in my mind, like literally in my pocket for a couple of days, all week long.
Wow.
Really just think about it, because this is all we have together. This is the person writes in a paragraph, two paragraphs. This is the whole world as I know it. And so it behooves me to take it seriously and to think about all the different parts of that world. But then also to say, hey, I'm a stranger. So yeah. Yeah. Here's some advice, here's some expert opinions, here's some resources. Be responsible for the choices that you make.
Yeah.
One thing I was noticing looking back at some old advice columns, like pre-internet age, is that a lot of times the advice would be like, someone might describe an alcoholic family member.
Yeah.
Someone suffering from alcoholism, and the advice columnist would say, well, here's a number to call, or here are some resources. And you could still do that now. But these days, probably a lot of people can find that part on their own. There's Google, like you said, there's Reddit. So you do need to evolve a little bit, because it can't just be purely resource-based. There has to be some other element to it.
Yeah. I think sometimes people's problems are sort of twofold. One is like, technically, logistically, what do I do here? And, like there was a question a couple weeks ago. Someone, their cousin was probably in the middle of a romance scam. Somebody from a different country was like, we're in love. Come over here. Marry me. Leave your mother behind. All this stuff. And so there's the resources, the logistical question of like, what do I do?
Right.
And so for that, I was like, well, here's the FBI's romance scam website. Here is, here's different places that you can report and read about romance scams. Here's ways to do reverse image searches, all these sort of technical things. The other side of it is, I am a person who wants my given circumstances to be different. And that is, I think, what I pay even more attention to, because I know that you can Google, and I sometimes you don't know what you're supposed to Google. And so I can do that. I can do that work for you. But what I also want to make sure I'm paying attention to is, what is the blockage in your life as a person that's keeping you from what you actually want? And that's what I want to speak to.
Yeah,
I want to, because the world has changed rapidly in the past several years.
Yeah.
You know, we had COVID, technology, social media, all these things. And a lot of folks just don't know what to do, especially socially. And there's a lot of petty problems. And I saw that you wrote, petty problems can affect us in a strong way. It's important to recognize the truth of your emotions. Something I say all the time, this is you talking, this is so silly, but I do feel this way.
And I
want you to talk about the petty things that people think are petty, right? But they can take up a lot of space in your mind, in your psyche, and cause stress and anxiety. How do you help people walk through those types of things?
Oh, yeah. You have to take it as seriously as they take it, but then also take the 1,000 foot view. It's so funny. You read that quote back, and I was like, yes, I do agree with that. And it is something that I wrote. I agree with myself quite a lot.
You're consistent then.
Yeah. But like, okay, so here's an example. In the time that I was doing Dear Prudence and in the time that I've been doing Asking Eric, the majority of the questions that I get are, well, I'd not say the majority, but a good portion of the questions are about weddings, where someone was sat at a wedding. Mm. They didn't write a thank you note to me. I was going to a destination wedding for friends.
It's a good advertisement for elopement, by the way.
Oh my God. That's, I mean, truly, that is most of the time. I'm like, just go away. But it's usually the guests. The guests have all this anxiety about where they're placed in the social hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it can feel petty. It can feel like, okay, you didn't get to sit at this table and said you had to sit at that table, and you've thought about it for 5 years. I never want to be a person who's like, get over it. You know, like, I'm not Olympia Dukakis or Cher in Moonstruck, you know, snap out of it. Like, I want to take it seriously, but I also want to say, like, I grant you that this feels really bad. I also want to, like, encourage you to let this part of it go or see it from this other part. Because I have plenty of petty problems. You know, somebody cut me off driving over here, and I was like, I'm going to miss this interview because I got to follow this person down the road just to see just see what's up. I'm like, if they're doing something wrong, I want to know about it. And, you know, you let it go.
Yeah. And one of the other things I noticed that you tend to do is encourage communication.
Yes.
Because a lot of people, like, have stuff going on in their head and won't have the conversation.
They just never let it out.
Yeah.
They never have the conversation, and they're not direct.
Mm-hmm.
So do you realize you could be a shield to people? They could blame you.
Yes.
You're like a deniability.
I mean, that's the thing. So many times people will write into advice columns and say, like, hey, just write the answer, and then I'm going to leave it on the kitchen table. You know, I see that all the time.
Oh.
And people, I think one of the major problems we have as people in any kind of relationship, work relationships, love relationships, siblings, family, is, am I saying the truth? Am I talking to you? Am I saying what I need to say to you? Can I say that? And sometimes you can't say it. And so then it's my job to say, like, here's a script. Here's how you do it. Write a letter instead of sending a text or whatever it is, you know.
We're talking about giving advice with advice columnist R. Eric Thomas. If you have a particularly good or bad piece of advice you've ever gotten, we'd love to hear it. Studio2@whyy.org or 888-477-WHYY. That's the number to call. Far more prosaic question for you, Eric. How do you pick the questions?
There's three or four criteria I look at. One, I try and give variety. It's 7 days a week, and it's usually two or three questions a day. And so I want to make sure
that's a lot of questions.
It's a lot of questions. It's a lot of problems. you know, I was talking to my therapist. I was just like, the other day, I was like, there's so many problems. People have a lot of problems. He was like, yes. I was like, have you heard?
Send that to the therapist.
Yeah, oh, my goodness.
I was like, I don't know if you're aware, but people are stressed out. Anyway, Mike, so I try and keep a variety. If it's one that's maybe about a senior looking at a different life stage, then I might pick another one that's maybe about somebody a little bit younger or a work situation, something like that. Two, I want to make sure the question is clear to both me and to the reader. And sometimes it's just editing. And sometimes it's like saying, like, okay, I don't quite know what's happening here. And the third is I always want to make sure I can answer it well, but even if it's a question that I'm like, oh, I don't know, I want to make sure I can do the research to get
it's
to the answer.
It's researchable.
It's researchable. Yeah. Some things, it's sort of like, I don't know what's happening here, you know, and sometimes I'll answer those and say, like, you know, it seems like from your clues, this and this and this. But if there's too many variables, then I just can't answer
exactly. You don't want to, be chucking darts. You want to exam. That makes sense.
Yeah, and I got to ask you this because another thing is your perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Because we said all the names of the advice columnists over the years, mm-hmm. mostly women and white women, in usually upper crust societal etiquette type.
Yes.
That has changed and evolved. Yeah. But you're a black man from Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and I'm just like, do you feel that your identity, does that sort of origin story tie in at all? How much? How little?
Yeah, yeah.
Does it matter?
I think where I'm coming from makes a big difference. And, you know, we talked about, they were very clear with me when I was going through the interview process. They said people are going to have, as I might say, feel some kind of way about you being a man, you being black, you being gay. Like, and that may turn them off. My position has always been, and this is the way I just feel about life in general. I'm 43 years old. I have spent 43 years projecting myself into other people's consciousnesses and lives and thoughts so I can protect myself. So I need to know what you're thinking about me so that I can know how to be safe in this environment. Huh. So like I do a lot of thinking about what other people are thinking and what people might be thinking about me. I also have a lot of empathy for other people and I have a lot of empathy for myself, which is something that I've learned through years of therapy. So I think that my identity is going to come with me, but you know, some people might look on the surface and say like, well, what do you know about, you know, being a retiree? Well, you know, I have not retired yet. You know, I just got another job. but
You're anti-retired.
Apparently. Think of it. Yeah.
So like, I have not walked a mile in your shoes, but I am empathetic to you. I've done a lot of work with seniors. I've talked to a lot of people at that life stage who have very different experiences. I know resources. I'm not an expert on what it is to be a black gay man either. I'm an expert on what it is to be me, Eric Thomas. And that makes, and as I show more and more compassion to myself, it allows me to be, to show compassion to the readers as well. And that's what people are looking for. They want someone to listen to them and to take them seriously.
The answer to this might just be no, but I'm curious, is there a type of advice that you simply would not give, an area you would not touch because you say, like, I cannot help in solving this type of problem? You kind of hinted at it earlier, like if there's too many unknowns. But I'm talking more about like a type of thing that people might typically ask where you're like, no, that's out of bounds for me. I do not want to get involved in that.
My first thought, and this is like semi-serious, but like I don't think I would give like sex advice.
That's a legit answer, I think.
Though. You know, just because it's one, it's a newspaper, and so like I'm just not sure what our standards are, and two, because because it's a newspaper. I'm doing it if you keep talking about this on the radio.
that's sufficient,
exactly.
But that's interesting to me though, because I assume that is something that people will write in about. And I think there have been columns that are more like focused in that way, where they're more even soliciting questions on that topic.
Yeah, yeah.
But not every advice column is going to do that.
Yeah, there's one in Slate. Dan Savage has one. You know, they're great. I think what I would do, though, if someone asked me like, you know, because people do ask about like, oh, you know, actually, there's a question I'm ruminating on right now where a woman's talking about how she and her husband aren't intimate anymore and he hasn't paid any attention to her. But she has this friend and they watch TV together and they're very close. And I'm really trying to decide whether my advice should be open your marriage. That's a spicy take for a lot of people.
Sure is.
But it does sound like from the context of what's, because the husband won't entertain a divorce. He doesn't want to go to therapy. Okay. Well, there's another structure there. If you've gotten close to this other person who makes you feel very good. So I would talk about intimacy, but I'm not going to, like, give you a mechanical sexual advice. I'm just, you know, and, like, you know, I might talk to a sex therapist if there's a question that really involved, like, that really requires it. But I think that we are moving to a different space that is sort of, like, becomes more physiological and less about people.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting distinction, right? Because there is a gray line there, but it does sound like there's And that's, I think that's part of being self-reflective. Like, I'm just not the person for this type of advice. There are other people.
Yeah.
I'm really good at this type of advice. Mm-hmm. I don't feel as comfortable giving this type of advice. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if there was a question about child discipline, you know, I would absolutely like talk to some experts. But I know that, like, you know, if there's a question about spanking, I think I might feel a compunction to really outsource it.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Well, look, we could go on for a long time about this, because the process of giving advice is not simple.
Yeah.
But perhaps we can have you back on another time as the column gets rolling.
Yeah. It's always a pleasure. Friend of the show now.
It's just a pleasure talking to you. It really is. That's our Eric Thomas, who writes the nationally syndicated advice column Asking Eric. He's also a television writer, a best-selling author, and his recent book is called Congratulations, The Best Is Over. And oh, by the way, lives in Philly.
I do.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up next, a conversation on fatherhood and parenting ahead of Father's Day. Studio 2 will be right back.
So listen up, Buster, and listen up good. Stop wishing for bad luck and knocking on wood.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manert.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Father's Day is coming up on Sunday. And let's be honest, compared to Mother's Day, it's kind of the undercard. In fact, Mother's Day was nationally recognized a half a century before Father's Day in this country.
I'm not shocked. And of course, mothers should be celebrated. Mm. And, you know, traditionally, Cherry, mothers have been seen as the pillars of family life. And dads were providers, maybe disciplinarians. But for Philly dad Joe Gajunas, that was not enough. He wanted to be more for his son, and he wants to start a conversation about fatherhood in the modern age.
Just so happens he's doing it on national television. Joe is the host of a new docuseries called Grown Up Dad. It will air on PBS stations across the country, including here on WHYY this Sunday. The pilot features a lot of frank discussions about fatherhood, and he recently sat down with Studio 2's resident dad, our very own Avi Wolfman-Arendt, for a chat just all about that.
It's cool for me to have this conversation with you because I'm a dad and you're a dad.
And again, congratulations. It is a great ride.
Yeah. And it's sort of new for me. I've only been doing it for a little over a year, but I can't recall many conversations that I've had with dads about being a dad, which is kind of like the seed behind the whole series,
it
right?
Is. Yeah.
You know, like we're just not talking about
we're
this
not
stuff.
Talking about this stuff. And so I came about this from in the beginning of the pandemic. I've got a 3-year-old and I just feel wholly unprepared to be a good dad. And my dad was a provider, but there'd be months where, you know, I'd only see him a few times every month. Mm. And so when your dad is not around, when those stories and experiences aren't passed down to you, how do you figure out how to be a good dad? And so I really didn't have anyone in my orbit that I wanted to have a role model of. And then you turn to media and, you know, I grew up with, you know, Al Bundy and, you know, Tim the Toolman Taylor kind of thing. And they're funny. They're lovable.
TV dads.
Yeah, TV dads. And but they're bumbling. They're not someone I want to emulate, even though they were funny and lovable. So I'm like, where do I turn to? And I wasn't finding anyone. So I'm like, I need to figure this out because I did not want to repeat history, the kind of childhood I had. I wanted to be there more for my kid. And it's like, all right, let's go explore. Let's go talk to people.
So your dad, you said, was certain months barely around. That's right. Because of work stuff?
Yeah, he was a traditional provider. And honestly, if you check that box in his generation, you were a good dad, you know?
Yeah.
And but to me, if you're just a provider today, I don't know if you'd consider yourself a good dad. I think you really want to be there more for your kid. And both for selfish reasons, too, both for your kid. Like, there's so much research about how a more involved dad is going to have children that are more self-reliant. They're going to do better academically. They're going to have more grit and resiliency. And on a personal note, I have more joy and fulfillment in being a dad than in anything else in my entire life. And no one told me that.
Underlying all of this is the fact that dads are more present.
They are.
In their kids' lives. So you quote some statistics in the pilot episode of the series. 1965, I think the average dad was providing 2.5 hours mm-hmm. a week mm-hmm. of childcare. 2016, so about, what, that's like 50 years
mm-hmm.
later,
mm-hmm.
8 hours a week,
mm-hmm.
2.5 to 8.
Yeah, you nailed it. And I think even today, those numbers are higher. I think the pandemic definitely showed a lot of dads that we can be more present and we're moving in the right direction.
So dads are around more. I think the question is, how do you translate around more to something meaningful?
That's a great question. You know, and I think that every dad has to ask themselves that question. No one's asked dads, what does that mean? And today, it might be the best time in history to be a dad because we get to ask ourselves what kind of dad we want to be, because we don't have to do the same things that our dads and the generations before them did. And so to me, finding that intentionality has been both most rewarding and the most challenging.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the hardest things to understand is I'm there. What do I do? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm talking about like real life, minute to minute, hour to hour. Is it good enough to just be there and if she's got a question, I'll answer it and I'm making sure she doesn't kill herself? Or am I supposed to be doing something proactive to father? Like, that's the hardest thing for me to parse. I mean, how do you go about trying to figure that out?
And it's different with every age. And I can say it gets easier once they get a little bit older. There's so much more to do.
Yeah, my kid doesn't really talk
yet. So you have a one-year-old, right? I mean, to me, the best things to do are help make them laugh and just be a goofball and, you know, make faces, make noises, and, you know, just whatever you can do to play games and build their skills. But as they get older, they begin to talk and have opinions and they can play games with you and they can go out and run with you. And then they start beating you at things too. And then you're oh man, that is a little embarrassing. My 7-year-old just beat me at this, you know?
What game specifically are we talking about here?
It started with Uno. Once he beats you like 4 times in a row, you're like, oh, it's not luck. He's actually doing better at me in this game. And there's also, you know, trying to be their dad. You know, it's being their friend and being their dad. And that's what I'm trying to balance right now. Because you also have to be like, okay, that's enough screen time. Or, no, you can't have your 3rd snack in a row at the moment. It's like, we've got to get to bed now. And for some reason, they have a jolt of energy every time as soon as you say it's time for bed.
You mentioned trying to strike that balance between being a friend and being like a boundary setter.
Yeah.
And dads traditionally have been more involved, I think, in the discipline side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine dads still should be part of that. It's not like take all of the things that the traditional dad did and like abandon them.
Right. I think about trying to get my kid to thrive.
Yeah.
You know, I think every parent wants their children to have the best life. And that is more complicated than ever today. We now have the world of information at our fingertips, and so do they. I'm working on an episode now for next year about screen time dilemma, and it is about video games and phones and social media. And right now, because my son is 7, video games are, you know, a large part of his world. And for a kid that is fantastic, and I work with him on, you know, transitions and healthy reactions, honestly, video games do something a little bit different to him. Honestly, he can be a little bit of a jerk, you know, and when after a certain amount of time on video games and I'm like, whoa, where did this come from? Like, he's got like mush brain, you know, kind of thing. And it's really hard to see that when we've worked so hard on so many other things and he's doing great and thriving. But then this part of his life, like he's different. And so we're trying to really work on ways to transition things to understand, like, how do we help him see that this is more supposed to be just fun, you know, and enjoyable. But he's getting a little too competitive and a little too, you know, involved and forgetting about the rest of his life. So those are things that are really challenging right now for me and my family.
I want to backtrack a little bit. You mentioned earlier that your dad wasn't the role model that you wanted for your fathering experience. When did you realize that? Or did you know from the beginning, like, I'm not going to be like my dad?
Well, that's a tough one. I think a lot of men have complicated relationships with their fathers, and I'm no exception. I think right now I have a good relationship with my dad because he is actually a good grandfather to my son, a position he's earned. And it's sometimes hard to watch, but he's, he's going to have a better relationship with my son than I think he's going to have with me. And I love my dad very much, and I know he did what he could. But I think early on, my impression of fathers were more as like drive-by parents, as people who, you know, it was nice when they were around, but they weren't essential. And I decided I didn't want to repeat that. Even though I know he tried and he did his best, he's not going to have the relationship with me that he is with my son. And I'm glad my son's going to have that. And I hope that that relationship flourishes for both of them.
In the pilot, you talk to experts, but you also just have like a lot of very real conversations with other dads. In those conversations, do you recall getting a single piece of advice that was mind-blowing or game-changing for you? Something that just really stood out from all the conversations?
For me, the best advice is actually coming from the cartoon animated show Bluey. Bluey is this fantastic show out of Australia that has taken over a lot of like the young childhood consumption for shows. Yeah. And I love it. And people have argued that it's actually a show for parents that kids just happen to like too. But the dad in this show is named Bandit, and I think he's the best written dad ever on television. And so part of the show, I go to Australia and I talk to other dads about what it's like to be a father down under. And I have these great stories about more involved dad and how much more just support they seem to get there. And I come back here and honestly, I'm hearing criticism of the show being like, well, those parents are, they're too perfect. Like no one can be like them. And I look at it and this show is only 7 minutes long. And I say to myself, they're not perfect parents, but they're really good for 7 minutes. And my lesson that I took away from all this is like, can I be a great dad 7 minutes at a time? Because when I'm exhausted, when I'm like, how am I going to get to the end of the day? How am I going to get to bedtime tonight? Because, you know, days are hard and we're tired. We're doing a lot as working parents. I think, okay, I can find the strength for 7 more minutes because that's going to give my son the core memory of the day. That's what they're going to remember, is that energetic burst of play and fun. And when I can be intentional for 7 minutes, I feel like a great dad. And so that's what I do when I've like, I've got hours left in the day, but I can do a couple of great 7 minute bursts and have a good night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be a passerby. I'm not going to be someone who just stands passively in the background.
Yeah.
Even as I try to do all my other stuff.
Yeah. And you think about dads over the generations, right? Like there's, you know, if you were a 50s dad, like, yeah, you came home and you're like, yeah, good to see you, kid. All right. Like,
off to the study.
Oh, yeah. Off to the study, right? Come home. Like, in the 80s dad's a little bit, you know, slightly more involved, but still there's, I think there's still a lot of work that the 80s dad has to do. And today, we've made a lot more progress. I mean, the millennial dad is doing a whole lot more than any other generation, and we should be recognized for that. But if we don't take this moment to say, what is it that we want to do, and how can we take that to the next level, I think we as dads are missing out on something. Because I feel stronger as a dad when I'm more present with my family. Mm. And that's not a message that's out there. I think the message is we need to be still more, you know, we should be doing anything other than almost being with our families to feel like we're a man. And I'm like, I am so happy and joyful when I'm with my family, but I also recognize I need to be good at my job. I need to be a good partner to my wife, and I want to be a great friend still. And so I still need time away. I still need me time. But when I get to be intentional with that time, it's really something special that no one ever told me was going to happen in my life.
There you have it.
Beautiful interview.
Thank you,
Avi. And happy Father's Day in advance.
Thank you. It made me think actually listening back about my own dad, who's really ahead of his time, was really doing all this stuff a generation before a lot of dads were doing it. And still is.
Yeah.
Happy Father's Day, Dad.
All right. And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Studio 2. Quick plug, I'll be interviewing attorney, journalist, and author Sunny Hostin tonight at WHYY. She has a new book out called Summer on Highland Beach. Hope you check it out. You can go to whyy.org/events for more. Thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered today's show. WHYY's audio general manager is Joan Isabella. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And by the way, I'm told tomorrow is your third anniversary at WHYY. Happy anniversary, Cherry Gregg. You are a public radio nerd now.
Hey,
you are in.
I'm graduated.
You're stuck with us, and we are so glad that you are. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you next week.